That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This is the John Fugelsang Podcast.
Welcome back to SiriusXM. I'm John Fugelsang. For decades, tobacco companies have aggressively targeted African Americans and have directly contributed to the skyrocketing rates of heart disease, stroke, and cancer across the black community. Now, as you may know, more than 83% of black smokers choose menthol. And the scientific evidence shows menthol cigarettes are more addictive, easier for kids to start smoking, and harder for smokers to quit. African Americans die at significantly higher rates of smoking-related illnesses. Now, President Derek Johnson and the NAACP have worked tirelessly to support the FDA's proposed rules to prohibit menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars. They've consistently led on the issue of fighting how they're marketed, and they've had mixed success with the Biden administration. But it's just been announced that the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids is going to present Derek Johnson, president and CEO of the NAACP, with their highest honor, the Champion Award, for his unyielding leadership in working to eliminate menthol cigarettes and end the tobacco industry's predatory marketing to kids, African Americans, and other communities. It is such an honor to welcome the president of the NAACP, Derek Johnson, to SiriusXM. Hello, sir.
How are you doing today? And thank you for having me on.
I'm thrilled you're here, and I'm thrilled you're being honored for this kind of work. I got to say, I'd be more thrilled if this White House was as consistent and on top of this issue as you and the NAACP have been. Sir, I have this long memory. I remember the Biden administration getting ready to announce that they were going to propose a ban on menthol cigarettes way back in 2021. Sir, what happened to that ban?
Well, I can say it didn't happen. That's what happened. It did not happen. You know, flavored tobacco has been banned for every flavor except menthol. The tobacco lobby has been aggressive in trying to prevent this ban, and they've used organizations and individuals to misinform the public, saying that it would increase police interaction with African-American men, which is far from true, because in the ban, the recommended language, it will put the punishment on the companies, not the individuals.
Yes.
And therefore, there's no reason to prevent this ban from taking place. But I do want to say Campaign for Tobacco Kids, they have done a great job making sure that all of us who are opposed to the menthol flavored cigar stay focused, stay clear, providing the facts. And this is a type of fight that's not only important for African Americans, it's important for everyone. It's important for the health of our nation.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, last December, when the Biden administration announced their delay in having the FDA's final menthol rule, you wrote, sir, a scorching op-ed for MSNBC that I actually bookmarked and saved at the time. And you said the White House's decision this month to delay the FDA's rule banning menthol cigarettes puts politics and profit over the health of black Americans. Make no mistake, by heeding the cynical arguments of the tobacco industry and its well-organized lobbying effort, President Biden's administration is sending an unacceptable message that black lives do not matter when it comes to fighting tobacco use, the leading cause of preventable death in our country. It's a brilliant piece. Was it the lobbyists, sir? Was that the reason why the White House and the FDA ultimately took a step back from this?
I mean, we believe so. 39% of all of the entire cigarette market is the menthol market. African Americans, we only make up about 13% of the total populations, but
that's right.
41% of all menthol-related smoking deaths. Those are startling statistics. And so for this administration to heed the lobbying efforts of an industry that has been proven to be dishonest in their marketing, that has been proven to be predatory in their outreach, that have created a process in which they increase the addictive properties of cigarettes and then flavor it to mask the taste of tobacco, only to have people addicted to the cigarettes, causing a health crisis across this country, but particularly with African Americans. It is no justifiable reason for the flavor of menthols to still be intact when this administration has already banned every other flavor.
Yep, that's it. I was reading how in the 1950s, only about 10% of black folks used menthols, and today that proportion is more than 85%, three times the rate for Caucasian smokers. And the studies show that menthols are more addictive and they're harder to stop. So, Mr. President, there really is no debate over whether the menthol is harmful. The evidence is overwhelming and the evidence is consistent, right? There's no debate on this.
There's zero debate. Listen, if people want to smoke cigarettes, they should be free to smoke cigarettes. But don't do a bait and switch, make it taste different than what it actually tastes like, and then amplify the addictive properties within the cigarettes so people can become addicted because of the taste is attractive and because of the nicotine that's in there, it becomes more addictive than naturally it should be. That's something that this industry has done to put profit over people as opposed to the health of our citizens over shareholder value. That
Amen.
Shouldn't be the case.
I mean, it was 2009. It's 15 years ago that the FDA had the authority to regulate tobacco, and they banned all the flavors except menthol. And I want to ask you, sir, how has the tobacco industry done this historically, the way that they have directly marketed and preyed on the African-American community? I mean, this has been a process that's taken many decades to produce these kind of awful, drastic health results. Over the years, how has the industry made its way into the black community?
Well, it's the same way they did it for all of America. If you can recall, in the 80s and definitely the 70s and before, cigarette smokers were everywhere. You smoked cigarettes on the plane. You smoked it in the office. It was common for people smoking in the house until there was an aggressive campaign around secondhand smoke and getting the label on the cigarettes. And then you had the tobacco lawsuits of the 1990s. It began to address the very creative marketing arm of the tobacco industry. And the last vestige of that lobbying arm, that marketing arm, has been targeted to minority communities such as the African-American communities and other communities outside of the United States.
Yeah.
What we take a clear position in ACP. We don't take tobacco money. We have not taken tobacco money for decades. We understand the health crisis is creating not only in our community, but across the country. And we say that if individuals want to smoke cigarettes, they should be able to do so, but not under a bait and switch proposition, make it taste better and increase the nicotine properties in it so you become addicted longer. That should never be acceptable for any industry.
That's it. And you know what? Unlike many of the White House's plans, a ban on menthol cigarettes or flavored cigars, it doesn't require congressional approval, does it? So, I mean, the FDA has to put out their proposed rules, but this would take years of regulation and legal battles anyway. It's going to be a long process no matter what. I don't understand why the government is adding more delay.
It's a political question at this point, and that's why we know it's the effective lobbying of the tobacco industry. They put a lot of money out, so elected officials and others read the talking points that misinform communities misdirect towards the health crisis that we are confronted with as a result of menthol-flavored tobacco.
And as you've said many times, research shows that menthol contributes heavily to young smokers of all races and backgrounds starting because it masks the throat irritation that's caused by cigarettes. I'm curious, Mr. President, what have the parents you work with said about this issue? And Are you finding a lot of support?
I've yet to find any opposition. That's what's fascinating. We have finally evolved as a nation, as a culture, where cigarette smoking is less tolerant than in the past. Again, you don't find people smoking cigarettes indoors in public facilities, and that's how we expect it to be, because we want clean, fresh air. And individuals who decide to smoke, there are designated areas outside to do so.
Right on.
Well, the African-American community and any other community who get addicted because of the bait and switch nature of flavoring the cigarettes so you can mask the harsh taste in order to increase the number of smokers, thereby more people becoming addicted. That should not be the case. If people want to smoke, smoke a regular cigarette. You don't have to flavor it. And I can assure you, you'll have fewer smokers and a better quality of life for many Americans, especially African Americans.
Amen. To say nothing of the fact that this is a public health issue and it's an economic issue. I mean, it seems like this is the sort of ruling that would help not just public health, but the entire U.S. economy. This costs all of us, and this cancer costs all of us. But let me push back a little bit, because some folks, including Reverend Sharpton, who's a friend of this show, said it would be discriminatory to outlaw a product that is particularly popular among African Americans. And other critics have said this could lead to, you know, an underground market of menthol cigarettes, and point to the case of Eric Garner, who got murdered by the cops for selling loose cigarettes. How do you and the NAACP respond to points like that?
Most of the time, I simply don't, because both of those arguments are not legitimate arguments. One, the ban, in the language of the ban, will place the penalty on the manufacturers of the product, not the individuals. So there is no Eric Garner threat here. Part two, the discrimination is the ability of an industry to specifically target the only flavor known to attract African Americans, where all the other flavors have already been banned. That's a discriminatory act, particularly when it is creating a health crisis. The number one cause of death with African Americans, this product. That's discrimination.
Yep.
And so we don't respond oftentimes to those arguments, because those are manufactured talking points by the tobacco industries to try to create the justifications for what's taking place. And what's taking place is a health crisis.
Amen. I've talked to some liberals and progressives who thought that this whole thing could backfire, and that if it went through, maybe a lot of black voters would be really angry at Joe Biden and it would hurt the reelection campaign. I don't know if there's any credence to that, but do you have hopes that a second Biden term could produce some concrete results?
Well, we need concrete results. And I have yet to hear a single person to say, "Ooh, if they ban menthol, I'm going to not vote for." It doesn't even register on the Richter scale of concerns in the African-American community.
A lot of anti-smoking groups who have been frustrated by Washington's inaction on menthols have turned to states and localities to request bans. What do you think of that approach, and how has that gone?
You know, I think at the end of the day, we need executive order. We cannot have a hodgepodge of rules where one state have one set of rules and another state have a more lenient set of rules. That's how you open up a black market. You don't have a uniform set of rules across the board. And that's what we need.
You know, it's crazy to think about, but I was going back through my records and cigarette sales rose huge in 2020 during COVID. Despite the threat of respiratory infections plaguing the world, government data shows that cigarette sales went up massively. They sold over 203 billion cigarettes in 2020, about 800 million more over 2019. It really seems like COVID-19 slowed us all down and caused a lot of backsliding in this fight.
Well, you think about the pandemic is going to have a ripple effects for years to come that we're going to be studying. The social distancing for a lot of people created social isolation. And many people turn to vices just to manage being isolated from normal human interaction. And so you've seen a lot of sales go up in terms of vices that allow people to self-medicate or calm nerves.
That's right.
And that's unfortunate. But it shouldn't be as a result of a flavoring of the cigarettes. If people during COVID-19 decided to smoke, it shouldn't have been one that they were coaxed to because it tastes good. When in fact, tobacco is tobacco. Tobacco should taste like tobacco.
Let me ask you one more question on this, and it's kind of a what if, because the administration is still considering another possibility of fighting this, which is, if they don't ban menthols, requiring the tobacco companies to lower the amount of nicotine in cigarettes to non-addictive levels. Would that be an acceptable compromise, or is that another example of the government shirking their responsibility?
I think it shouldn't be either or. It should be a both and. Right, you know that they are increasing the properties that cause addictions. You should require it to be lowered to more of a natural concentration of nicotine, not an amplified concentration of nicotine to cause addiction. It is a drain on our health system as a result.
I couldn't agree more, and I think it's so great you are waging this fight. I feel like I've beaten up on Joe Biden a little bit here, so I want to ask one positive question. How do you feel seeing Biden closing the gun show loophole? How positive a movement was that?
I think anything we can do to address the scourge of gun violence in this country is always a positive move. More to be done, but I'm glad there's just another step of chipping away of keeping Americans safe.
Derek Johnson is president and CEO of the NAACP. He's being honored by the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids with their Champion Award. And it's such a pleasure, sir. I'm a longtime fan. I really love what you do and how you do it. Thank you so much for joining us on SiriusXM.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Have a great one. And we'll be right back.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome back to SiriusXM. I am John Fugelsang. Now, you might have noticed lately that the millionaires at birth of the Trump family are now asking non-millionaires to send them money. Donald Trump, his eldest son, and Lara Trump have all in the last month or so been using the same language in these little video fundraising pitches. It goes something like this. We're very grateful for your support. If you can't afford to help right now, we understand. Put your family first. We get it. But if you can chip in anything today, it'll go a long way to make America great again. All three of them have put out videos in just the last 6 weeks with virtually the same language. Now, I'm old enough to remember a different talking point from way back in the olden days of 2015. I don't need anybody's money. I'm using my own money. I'm not using the lobbyists. I'm not using donors. I don't care. I'm really rich. Donald Trump. So what changed? Well, Alexandria Jacobson is an investigative reporter with Raw Story. She focuses on money and politics and government accountability. Her reporting has been published everywhere from the Chicago Sun-Times, the Chicago Tribune, ABC News. Her investigative work has been recognized with a Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award. And her ongoing Lawmakers Lawbreakers series just took top prize in the prestigious Best in Business Award, personal finance category. She also just won the prestigious Sydney Award for her months-long investigation into violence against letter carriers and a recent spike in mail-related crime. But this is all about her new pitch, her new story, From Really Rich to Begging, Inside Trump's U-Turn on One of His First Campaign Lies. What a pleasure to welcome Alexandria Jacobson to SiriusXM.
Thanks so much for having me, John. Excited to be here.
Thank you. So what inspired you to take on this story? I was thrilled to see it because I've really been noticing, like I said, not just that they're all doing these little grubby fundraising, send me a nickel emails, but they're all using virtually the same language. We're so noble. We know what it's like to struggle and have a hard time taking care of your family. So put them first, but give us money. What is shifted in your reporting that you've seen?
So we very much follow everything that Donald Trump and his campaign is putting out, and exactly what you said, thinking back to not so distant history, that how much the tone has changed. So we get emails from Donald Trump saying, hey, buy these golden sneakers, get a membership card from me. Just please help me out. I'm in facing a witch hunt. We need anything you can give to the smallest donors. Please help, please help, please help. Of course, he also has courted mega donors in the last couple elections as well. But this is a complete change from 2016 when, as you mentioned, he would say, I don't need anyone's money. Anyone that talks to lobbyists or the big mega donors, they're puppets. They're sellouts.
That's
so
right.
We thought it was, as we're on our third election with Donald Trump, it was worth revisiting just really how much his tone has changed over these 8 years.
I have to be honest, I'm not ashamed to admit it. In the early days of the 2015 primary debates, and there were debates all the time, we all tuned in for Donald Trump. He was thrilling because he was saying the sort of things in the early days of the primaries that he'd never say now. He was fighting for single payer. He was talking about confiscating guns from people. And he was talking about the culture of corruption and bribery that owns D.C. I saw liberals and standing up and cheering when he said, you know, I pay these guys off. Guys like me buy guys like this. And we really thought, well, he's batshit and he's just in it for the fame. But my God, he's telling some powerful truths. What a incredible 180 to have him disparaging lobbyists and now seemingly permanently it's just another guy with a cup in his hand.
Donald Trump very much in the 2016 days was, I'm an outsider to politics. That spoke to a lot of folks. And, you know, I'm different. I have all this money. I don't need anyone's and they're not going to influence me. And it turned out to be a lie. When you look at the numbers, Donald Trump back in 2016, put up $66 million, which, hey, that's a lot of money for his campaign. But he ends up raising hundreds of millions of dollars. So he got the mega donors. He got the small donations. So really, as his original call that he was going to self-fund his campaign, that wasn't exactly or actually the case at all. So, yes, quite a different pitch from 2016. And now, yeah, the reality is that he's doing what politicians he's accused of have always done. He's cozying up to lobbyists, the mega donors, and he's not afraid to ask for small donations too, anyone for money.
Now, the $66 million of his own cash, that is impressive, as you say, and he raised hundreds of millions. Did he make a profit on it? Did any of his Trump-owned businesses reap the benefits of those campaign payments?
Yeah, so he at least was able to, in that 2016 campaign, bring in about $11 million being reimbursed back to Trump hotels and Trump properties. So he got money there, too. And originally, the $66 million, a lot of that money was loans, but he ended up forgiving some of those loans. So he did put up some of his money, but he got some back, too.
Yeah, well, and of course, he made tons and tons. I mean, it's going to take decades to know how much money he raked in while serving as our president and to know from what foreign governments he raked it in from. What about 2020? Did he put his own money up for his reelection campaign?
Nope, not a penny. 2020, he courted more than 100 mega donors that really helped boost his campaign. So, nope, he didn't in 2020. 2024, we've not seen any Trump money on the line yet. He has said as recently as last month, he might put up his own money. But really, we've seen no evidence of that, particularly as he's facing extreme legal expenses right now.
So, in other words, the same people that he said turned his opponents into little puppets are the people he's going to bail him out right now.
Yep. He specifically called out Sheldon Adelson, the late Sheldon Adelson, back in 2016 and said, hey, Marco Rubio, you're a puppet for cozying up to him. And guess what? Who gave him $90 million? Miriam and Sheldon Adelson in 2020. And just earlier this year, he went to a fundraiser where Adelson and all sorts of billionaires were at a swanky fundraiser in Florida. And they raised more than $50 million for Trump there. So quite a shift from those early 2015 tweets.
And Jill Nadelson wanted one thing for his $90 million. He wanted the U.S. embassy moved to Jerusalem, and that's exactly what he got. He paid $90 million to have an obedient politician do his bidding. And we all watched it happen right in front of us.
That's right. Donald Trump proved that he said he couldn't be bought. And it certainly appears that he could be, given the amounts of money that he was taking from these mega donors that he said he would never even talk to.
Now, I know we shouldn't be surprised that he's gone to such great lengths to make money any way he can, from the sneakers, the perfume, the cologne, the Bibles, the softcore gay porn, weird NFT cards of him with other men's muscles. It's all just very strange, but I guess we shouldn't be shocked. We have found out that they've been fleecing the flock in many ways over the past few years, including like Trump's donations, whereas normally you would check a box to give a donation every month. With Trump's website, you have to check the box to avoid giving a donation every month. And lots of folks didn't realize they were supposed to uncheck a box and wound up getting ripped off by this guy. So really, none of this should be a surprise. He hasn't been using his own money to get ahead in this game in over 8 years, right?
Yes, there has been a lot that has come up into light about Donald Trump's supporters being shocked that they're getting these automatic deductions from their accounts to donate to his campaign that they did not think that they were not aware they were being signed up for. And a lot of these folks, the $5, the $20 here, that makes a big difference. And it's been shocking to them. And so, yeah, Donald Trump, though, it seems, is not afraid to keep going back to the small donors and, you know, being pretty shameless and anything he can to make a dollar.
Well, we should talk about how Lara is fleecing the RNC and has pretty much been defiling their bank accounts like it's a Tom Petty song she's covering. I mean, this has got to be helping him to some degree now, that when you donate to the RNC, your money will be going not to Donald Trump's campaign necessarily, but definitely to Donald Trump's defense lawyers. This on top of, we learned that the Save America PAC has spent three of every $4 it has made on his defense attorneys. I have to say, I would imagine a lot of the small money donors are a bit weary of all of this. I subscribe to Trump. I get his fundraising emails all the time. It's been relentless nonstop. But what about the big money donors? I know he had a few guys in Florida show up at his retirement home to write some checks, but the traditional GOP big money donors, I mean, I would imagine a lot of these guys are hiding from Donald Trump like an underage beauty pageant contestant backstage in the dressing room.
Well, it's actually been interesting that Donald Trump has continued to court those mega donors for money, for help with his legal expenses. So not only is he going to the small donors for help with this, some of the recent figures I'd seen, at least $76 million from campaign committees have gone toward legal fees. So some of that's coming from the small donors. And then, of course, he's not afraid to go to the big donors, too, that can help him with the $400+ million he owes in the New York civil fraud case, and then the $80+ million in the E. Jean Carroll defamation.
But are the traditional big donors, the guys who open up their wallets for Bush, McCain and Romney, are they all turning out for this guy still, or are some of them holding back a bit? He seems increasingly desperate and worried about money.
Yeah, it seems that not everyone is lining up to help Donald Trump with these massive bills that he has. So some certainly are, you know, stepping back and trying to look the other way. But it hasn't stopped Donald Trump from still continuing to try to court these big money people for help. He's still trying to get as much money as he can.
Can you explain to me what the Trump 47 committee is and how they operate?
Yes. So Donald Trump has all sorts of joint fundraising committees, and that is one of the latest. So, one of the interesting things we saw in our investigation is that they took in a lot of big money in recent weeks. So at least eight donations of at least $800,000 have come into this joint fundraising committee. So it's one of the many that is supporting Donald Trump and going from all sorts of sources to keep boosting his campaign.
Eight donations of at least $800,000 each. I mean, that's 62% of the fundraising of the entire committee. I mean, it's certainly impressive, but it seems that the Biden campaign is building up a very significant war chest as well. These numbers keep going back and forth. We hear Joe Biden had a record setting $25 million night, and then 5 days later, Donald Trump has a record $50 million night. How are the two respective war chests comparing right now?
Yeah, so the latest fundraising numbers we saw definitely currently shows Biden with a significantly larger war chest. So Biden's numbers are more to the tune of $155 million in cash on hand that's still available right now. And Trump, it's about $42 million. But as you mentioned, these big fundraisers are happening right now. And the $50 million fundraiser that we mentioned just happened in recent weeks. So we'll continue to see if Donald Trump is able to close that gap and kind of what fundraising numbers will look like, or if Biden's going to keep pulling ahead.
Now, he told reporters that he might start contributing to his campaign like he did in 2016. Any signs of that actually happening, or was that just, I know it's shocking that Donald Trump might say things he doesn't mean to reporters, but is there any chance of that really happening? I don't see this guy spending any money he can avoid spending right now.
Certainly doesn't seem that way. When Donald Trump talked about this, it was in very vague and broad terms. Hey, I have a great company. I have a lot of money. Things we've heard before. And hey, he said before he would self-fund his campaign and he didn't. And in this case, it certainly seems unlikely that he would contribute to his campaign. He said it. But at this point, I wouldn't put money on Donald Trump putting a lot of cash into 2024 at this point.
I mean, based on your reporting, how concerned should we be about a foreign entity deciding to dump an extremely large amount of money into Donald Trump's coffers? There's so many ways it could happen. We know the NRA was used as a money laundering front in the previous election. We know that they could always come in and buy Donald Trump's failing Trump media stock with a $5 billion push. I mean, there are ways that foreign actors could suddenly juice this campaign, aren't there? Is that a concern of yours?
Certainly. And I think that's something that, you know, all of us investigative reporters and we hope the Federal Election Commission is looking out for, particularly when, you know, there have been recent questions of Donald Trump's campaigns using different firms, you know, potentially in the case of legal firms to distribute payments, kind of, you know, as a holding ground to then distribute payments, right, which is not legal. They need to disclose exactly who vendors are that are receiving payments and where donations are coming from and have transparency there. So it's absolutely something we'll all be keeping an eye out on, particularly at Raw Story. And I think it's a legitimate concern.
I mean, do you think he'll need to? Because it certainly seems to me that he's bled these MAGA suckers dry for years. I mean, maybe he can scrape a few more nickels out of them, but these folks have been giving to him over three election cycles now.
Yes. And, you know, what we found is that there is a bit of a Donald Trump small donor fatigue. People are, you know, kind of hitting that exhaustion of, you know, how many Trump membership cards do I really need? These are kind of worthless. You know, do I need 15 more
Trump
MAGA
bucks.
Hats? Yep. Trump bucks, all that, you know, the Bibles, all of those things. So, I think it'll be interesting to see kind of how the fundraising numbers continue to turn out there. And again, if he'll be able to compete with Joe Biden and, you know, Hillary Clinton certainly outraised him in 2016. And we know how that went. And the MAGA folks, it does seem, though, that even if they're not giving him money, there's very little that can sway them from not voting for him.
One last question on this. Has Sheldon Adelson's widow coughed up more money for him? It seems like he's waiting for check number two, but it kind of feels like the old Adelson's got what they wanted out of a first term. Is she going to come to his rescue?
So what we were seeing is it looked like she had pledged that she was going to give some money at that swanky $50 million fundraiser. But as far as we've seen, the check has not come through yet. So it'll be a kind of a wait and see game. And we'll be watching those financial disclosures.
Before I let you go, I just want to congratulate you on being recognized for the Lawmakers Lawbreakers series over there on Raw Story. And I remember you were writing how 37 members of Congress have violated a conflicts of interest law. Just out of curiosity, are these mostly failures to disclose stock trades, which is required under the Stock Act of 2012?
Yes. So the number, I think our latest number is at 42. So it keeps growing. We check this every single day to see what financial disclosures our members of Congress are filing. And oftentimes this is involving stock transactions not being filed in a timely manner, or potential conflicts of interest with their stock investments and different committees folks are on. So yeah, it's a range, but primarily this involves members of Congress and their stock assets not being disclosed appropriately.
Does it seem like regardless of who's running the DOJ, it's a bit selective in how they go after Congress members for this kind of insider trading?
Yes. And it really starts first with the House and Senate Ethics Committees. And they're the ones that are responsible for making sure that members of Congress are accountable and following the laws. But the penalties there are really, really minimal, that especially if you've got millionaire members of Congress, it means nothing to them. So if they break the law by not violating appropriately, it's a $200 fine. That's nothing. And you're talking millions of dollars. So yeah, there's really, and oftentimes those fees get waived. So there's really not the enforcement there. And there's often a blind eye being turned to these infractions. So yeah, we really do see selective pursuit of these violations.
Alexandria Jacobson is an award-winning investigative reporter with Raw Story. What is the best way for our listeners to follow you and keep up with all your work?
Yeah, so absolutely go to rawstory.com. That's where all our investigations will be. You can follow me on X now, Alexandria J News, and find me mostly on the Raw Story website.
It's so great to have you with us. Please come back again. Happy to offer you this platform anytime. And thank you. I look forward to seeing how Donald Trump's desperate fundraising goes for the next 6 months.
Absolutely. Great to be here. Thank you again.
We'll be right back.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome back to SiriusXM Progress. I'm John Fugelsang. Thanks so much for being with us. So Joe Biden celebrated Earth Day in a very interesting way. I hope you found out about it. I hope the media you consume told you what Joe Biden did on Earth Day, because he announced a $7 billion investment in solar energy projects nationwide, focusing chiefly on disadvantaged communities and unveiling a week-long series of what the White House said would be his historic climate actions. He was flanked by Senator Bernie Sanders, Ed Markey, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and he announced the first grants under the Inflation Reduction Act program that will ultimately help hundreds of thousands of low-income and disadvantaged households finally get solar power and save on their power bills. It'll also post openings for the first 2,000 positions of the American Climate Corps. Now, Steph Spears is the co-founder and CEO at Solstice, which connects households and businesses to community solar farms and clean energy. She serves on the board of directors of the Sierra Club Foundation and Clean Energy for America. It is a great pleasure to welcome Steph Spears to SiriusXM to talk about these new White House announcements. Hello.
Hi, John. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks so much for being here, and thank you so much for all the work and activism and leadership you've shown on this issue. Let me start with the basics. This was a very splashy announcement for Earth Day. For you, did it live up to the hype?
Absolutely. I mean, we hope every Earth Day would have that kind of celebration. You know, clean energy is going to be the greatest driver of an economic transformation in the next century. But there's a question of whether that economic transformation is going to be for all of us and not exactly just some of us. And the EPA answered that question this week.
I mean, it's pretty exciting to think that almost 1 million low-income households could be getting rooftop solar for the first time. That's progress I never expected.
Yeah, absolutely true. And it's also not just rooftop solar, but community solar too, which is a shared solar farm that even renters can subscribe to save on their electricity bills. But so few states actually have active programs right now. And those programs for rooftop solar and community solar are going to save those 900,000 households you're talking about $350 million on their electricity bills every single year. It's a lot of money.
I mean, It's amazing. Look, I have a lot of dumb questions I do need to ask you, Ms. Spears, and I apologize in advance for that. But for the folks out there, you know, it's frustrating that our media, as liberal as we hear they are, does not pay enough attention to climate related issues. And so I just want to ask you, basically, it's a relatively new idea, the concept of community solar. I mean, it's only been around for the past couple of years. When was the moment for you professionally that you realized this was an issue that needed to be addressed?
Yeah, my co-founders and I started Solstice, our organization that puts community solar in the hands of households and businesses across the country. We started it back in 2014, actually. And we noticed that when we looked around, very few people we knew had access to solar power. And it turns out that 4 out of 5 Americans are actually locked out of the solar market because they can't put it on their home, or they don't have the right rooftop, or their roof is facing the wrong way, or it's made out of the wrong materials, or they don't have the right FICO score to get financing, or they can't pay for the system up front outright. So mm-hmm. a lot of people are locked out of the solar market. And that's why a program like Solar for All is such a game changer, because it really is kind of creating the climate action that we should all be seeing. You know, it's giving people options beyond fossil fuels and options that are cleaner and cheaper. And so we can actually start to imagine the world, what it would look like if more people had access to clean energy the way that the world should be.
Well, I mean, when you think about the benefits to our economy for all of us, if people are having lower electric bills, I mean, people can't afford rooftop solar. That's always been the rap. You have to have $10,000 or $20,000 or more up front to pay for it, or you need to access solar financing. And residential solar has been regarded by many as something that is never going to be open to low-income Americans because there's so much upfront cost, and because less affluent folks do rent their homes or live in apartment buildings. So what's the way around it? I mean, in looking at this, it really seems like this is a way of stimulating the economy and putting more money in the pockets of the people who need it the most.
Absolutely. For all the reason that you talked about, the people that need solar savings the most are currently the least likely to get it, which is why the 4 gigawatts of solar that's going to be built by the Solar for All program is so crucial, because it's going to lower carbon emissions. It's going to put money in the pockets of families who desperately need it, like you said, John. And it's also going to be creating well-paying jobs all across the country in communities that have been left behind. And there's supposed to be 200,000 jobs that could get created out of the Solar for All program. And that's on top of the 270,000 jobs that have been created in the last 2 years from the Inflation Reduction Act incentives.
You mentioned that you need a high FICO credit score just to access financing for solar. I mean, it really does seem that historically, the deck has been stacked against low-income Americans, and it's almost like it's institutionalized against any kind of change. I mean, I guess Big Electric doesn't want to give up any customers too easily. Has that been a consistent obstacle?
Yeah. In terms of credit worthiness, you know, you talk about the FICO credit scores. Credit scores were invented in 1956 as an objective measure of our credit worthiness. But when you dig deep into them, they don't actually measure your rental bill history, your cell phone history, your utility bill history, which is very relevant to this case we're talking about. And so it's actually disproportionately ruling against low to moderate income Americans, communities of color, and even the rural poor. So if we're talking about solving climate change and building massively more solar projects across the country in just the next few years, it behooves us to make it easy for people to sign up. So programs like Solar for All does this. Our organization, Solstice, has created an alternative credit score to using FICO credit scores that looks at people's Brilliant. Utility repayment history instead. And there's a lot of organizations across the country that are working to make solar more accessible in local communities. Some folks that are doing that are like Grid Alternatives, Solar United Neighbors, Groundswell, Elevate Energy. They've been working hard for a lot of years to get solar to more low-income Americans. And that's what we need. We need this coalition. We need all hands on deck to solve climate change. And that includes also working with utilities to implement these low-income solar programs. They have to be a part of the coalition too.
Well, that's why I think the work of Solstice is so brilliant, because you're providing community solar to the Americans who can't put it in their own home, like renters and people, like you mentioned, whose roofs aren't right for installation. But rather than actually putting the solar in your home, you guys just, you buy a chunk of the neighborhood solar farm, and the electricity goes back to the grid until you see a credit that pops up on your monthly utility bill for the solar produced. It seems so efficient and moral and smart for the long-term economic and environmental survival of the country.
You're so right, John. You know, the fact that so many people are locked out of solar and rooftop solar specifically is the reason why community solar has grown so much in the last decade, is because there are all these people that really want to do the right thing. They want to take advantage of clean energy, and they want to save on their electricity bills too, but they just can't get access to solar projects. So community solar means that people can get guaranteed savings on their electricity bills in the states where state legislatures have allowed for that. And they don't have to disconnect from the utility. They don't have to pay anything up front. And they're getting a savings on their electricity bill. That is life-saving for some of these families out there. 60% of the country is living paycheck to paycheck. And so, and as we have conflict across the world, natural gas prices are going up, so people's electricity bills are going up.
That's it.
You know, all of this stuff is connected, and it's so exciting to start to build a future in which more people can access solar for the first time. And we can do, in doing that, we make a cleaner, healthier world for our future generations.
I mean, it's so smart and efficient and cost-saving and moral. I can't believe the government is doing this. But this is aligned with Biden's goal, he said, to direct, 40% of federal clean energy investment benefits to disadvantaged communities. I'm just shocked to see it actually happening. Solstice doesn't actually build solar gardens, right?
Yeah, we partner with the folks that build solar gardens, and we take care of the entire customer experience end to end. So we're in local communities enrolling households and businesses for solar farms. And then for the life of the 20 to 25 year project, we're managing the customer experience. So that's the billing, the crediting, the integration with people's utility accounts. And the idea is we take care of our customers for 20 to 25 years and make sure they have a good customer experience. And we can ensure for the developers that are building projects, they don't have to worry about finding customers, filling churn on their projects, because our collections rate and our subscription rate is quite high for the industry. It's 99%.
How much of your struggle is just with awareness of the issues and awareness of the progress? I mean, in a society where a profit-driven media is going to be all over a racist landlord reality show president having a lot of criminal trials, it's kind of shocking that something that impacts our lives a lot more, like Biden's announcement for Earth Day, has a pretty hard time making it through the airwaves. I mean, how much of your work is just about bringing people up to speed with where the reality's at?
You know, it's so interesting that you talk about this age of disinformation we live in, which is becoming more and more the status quo in clean energy. You're seeing a lot more disinformation campaigns on the local level against clean energy projects. And the fact of the matter is, no president has actually done more for climate change than Joe Biden. You know, when you're talking, it's not just solar for all and the Inflation Reduction Act, which includes the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund that is putting money in local communities. It's building domestic manufacturing plants in blue states and red states across the country and creating jobs. It's the Climate Corps that was also announced on Monday. They're just letting 20,000 young people join the climate movement and tripling that in the next decade. So there's a lot there. And yet, to your point, so few people actually know these facts. And I think it comes down to the fact that there's a lot of distrust and mistrust out there. And we can only move at the speed of trust. That's what we know every day in our work at Solstice, is when we're going into communities and trying to say, hey, here's a product that's actually going to be great for you. You're going to save money on your electricity bills. You don't pay anything upfront. You don't have to disconnect from the utility, and you don't have, you get guaranteed savings on your bill. People are so suspicious that that is real, that we are trying to bring them this product that only helps them. And so we've learned the only way that people will sign up in droves is if they hear this message from a trusted messenger, because we can only move at the speed of trust, and trust is earned, not entitled. So we go through our partners like municipalities and local nonprofits and employers, and they help us spread the word, and we share our revenues with them because we also believe in building wealth in local communities.
Amen. I mean, CBS polling found that even among voters who consider climate very important, 49% have heard either not much or nothing about Biden's historic climate investments and the other policy moves, and only 10% of the people who consider climate important have read a lot about this. So I get that it's uphill, and it seems like it's just a matter of people realizing over time. I mean, not everyone was into the internet for the first couple of years. It took folks a while to realize how much it could transform their lives.
That's so, so true. And there's actually another study put on by RARE, which is a behavioral economics institute that looks at climate. And they looked at what causes people to take climate action. And it was really fascinating. They looked at, it doesn't matter with whether you believe in climate change. It doesn't actually change whether you take climate action. There are a lot of people out there that believe in climate change, but don't take climate action. They said, okay, does it matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican? And the study showed it doesn't actually matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican in predicting whether you take climate action. It predicts whether you believe in climate change, not whether you take action. The only thing that really predicts whether someone is taking climate action defined as buying an EV, you know, recycling, composting, putting solar on your home. The one thing that predicts whether people take climate action is if everyone around them is doing it too.
It's so true.
We want to do what people we respect do. That's how we get our information these days, and for better or for worse. And so that's actually tells us, how do we spread the climate movement? How do we get more people to take climate action? We do it ourselves. We talk about it a lot. We spread the word, and we fight this disinformation that way.
You mentioned the American Climate Corps, and I'd like to get your thoughts on that. Biden's opening the first 2,000 positions in the Climate Corps, and it's going to engage young folks in being able to apply for these positions in 36 states, D.C. and Puerto Rico, to train them to install solar panels or you know, operate equipment, and have a pre-apprenticeship training to go through a partnership with the North America Building Trade Union and find ways to federal government jobs. How significant is this? This seems like something incredibly positive, both for our economy and our environment.
It's a game changer also, because when you talk to every single solar company, clean energy company, climate company that's operating in this country right now, they will tell you that one of their biggest pain points is they can't find enough workers. They can't find enough people within clean energy to that have the experience to do the work. So they're looking all across the whole economy for new workers to join this movement. And that's what we need. We need training and apprenticeship programs, which are also part of the IRA compliance stipulations, is you have to have apprenticeship programs if you're getting tax credits from the IRA. And, you know, when you look at the number of electricians we have across the country, we're going to need a million more electricians electrify everything. And when you look at the breakdown of these workforces, they don't look like America. It's little known fact, clean energy has fewer women working in it than the oil and gas and coal industry. So we need more people to be a part of this movement. Out of all the electricians in the country, only 2% of electricians are women. We need the workforce of clean energy to look like America, and the, you know, Climate Corps is part of that.
I have to ask you a somewhat awkward question now, because young voters, of course, are generally the ones who tend to be the most concerned about climate change. The older voters aren't going to have to live with the consequences of their inaction. Younger voters will. And younger voters are a key constituency for this White House as they try to hang on to the presidency. So I hate to talk about our friend Robert Kennedy Jr., but he's someone that I knew and admired for many years for his work as an environmental lawyer and for his activism. He also held an Earth Day event on Monday. Somehow he managed to score Nicole Shanahan as a special guest. I was really thrilled to see the Sierra Club and the National Resource Defense Council Action Fund publish an open letter calling Bobby Kennedy's campaign a dangerous conspiracy theorist and science denier whose agenda would be a disaster for our communities and the planet. I agree. And again, Kennedy's been on the show. I've admired him for years. But how dangerous is it for all the progress we've made with climate justice to risk this candidacy handing the presidency back to you-know-who?
It's incredibly, incredibly dangerous. When we think about the past 4 years, we've gotten closer to addressing the problem of climate change and a lot of other economic issues than we have in the history of our country. And we, you know, for those of us that felt like 2016 was a dark year because it felt like we were taking a step back in progress and time and the belief in moral values and the desire for our leaders to lead with moral values, the prospect of the election going back to 2016 is horrifying. And it will, in fact, mean that we will get farther and farther from solving climate change. It will, in fact, mean that wealth inequality will get worse. That's and right. That will make us less safe. And, you know, I used to work in national security before working in solar. So wearing mm-hmm. that other hat, like we have to make sure that what we're doing on climate is also making us safer and healthier as a nation, because all of these issues are interconnected. And the better that more people do, the more people we invite in the tent of economic prosperity, the safer we are. So when you have leaders that only seek to divide us, not to bring us closer to a future that's safer, cleaner, healthier, then you know, it's a rarely scary prospect. And the good thing is I started as an organizer. I know the power of organizing. I worked for a campaign with a guy with a funny name, as he described it. And he ended up going all the way to the White House. So he wasn't supposed to win that campaign. I've seen the power of organizing in climate too. If you get people going towards the same goal, amazing things can happen. And so that's on us. We have to organize. We have to get over our divisions. And we have a few months to do that to get this future in a better place.
Steph Spears is the co-founder and CEO at Solstice, connecting households and businesses to community solar farms and clean energy. How can our listeners learn more about you and about your work?
Yeah, you can go to our website at solstice.us, as in United States, or us, a collective, solstice.us, and you can find me personally on LinkedIn.
It's really a pleasure to have you. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while. I'm a great fan of what you do. Thank you so much for joining us on SiriusXM.
Thank you, John, for your incredibly insightful questions and driving us towards a cleaner future as well.
Oh, well, shucks. Now I'm going to make you come back again. All right, we'll be right back with your calls. This is Progress.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome Welcome back to SiriusXM. I'm John Fugelsang. I am always thrilled anytime we can convince, cajole, bribe our next guest to join us. Shaniqua McClendon is the Vice President of Politics for Crooked Media, home to the podcast you lot might enjoy, Pod Save America. She's a terrific political strategist, a very sought-after speaker and commentator on the media, politics, voting, and race. She began her career as a White House intern for President Obama. At Crooked Media, she has become a superstar leading their political strategy and civic engagement program, Vote Save America. We've talked about it before on this show. It's a website, it's an initiative, it's a community that's all about helping Americans go through each step they need throughout the year to have the impact they want, getting registered, learn about candidates on the ballot, volunteering locally. They've raised over $55 million for progressive causes and candidates, over 200,000 volunteer shift signups, over 30,000 poll workers recruited. This is what direct democracy looks like. And welcome back to a hero of direct democracy, Shaniqua McClendon. Hello.
Hi, thank you. Every time you say it, I'm like, man, this is really, really nice stuff he's saying, but thank you.
It's really nice stuff you're doing. I mean, we talk about this all the time. And how do you push for not just voter engagement, but for enthusiastic voter engagement when the media is both sidesing the Republic to death this year with stories about how little enthusiasm mainstream America has for the two men at the top of the ticket? I think that's a complete bullshit argument we'll get to. But what you guys have done to remind everybody that it doesn't matter who the president is, it's all about the down ballot, is, I think, one of the most important forces that's going to protect our democracy right now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, the news, you know, I have a journalist degree. I respect the news. But something has happened with political journalism where instead of telling people what's happening, how a policy or a candidate might affect them, it's just how does, you know, this bill affect Joe Biden's ability to get reelected? And it's like, well, maybe people should know that, one, this bill needs to be passed. Does their member of Congress support it or not support it? Should they, you know, encourage them to take a stance on it? And then can we get it to the president? And if that happens, then how does it affect people? And, you know, I get frustrated, but I do think that it has created an opening for us to kind of communicate those things to people. But to your point about down ballot races, again, that's not something that traditional, I should say more so like broadcast cable news. I don't know why I hate saying mainstream media. I mean, word means
I hate saying it
thing,
too.
It does mean something. But, you know, as local journalism has kind of, you know, unfortunately gone away, we're seeing a lot less coverage on local elected officials. But I always tell people the people that you can run into in the grocery store, the people who have the most direct impact on your day-to-day life, because they are making decisions about what's happening in your backyard, a pothole, just, you know, everyday things. But also when we think about things like abortion and reproductive rights, right now we're seeing how much power states have. In places like California, you see Governor Newsom going, you know, as far as he can to create a place, one, where Californians have access to choice, but also, you know, right now is pushing for Arizona abortion providers to be able to be certified in California in case they need to, you know, come into the state and provide those services, because in Arizona, the state Supreme Court, again, these local races upheld, I think it's 1864 abortion ban. Yep. Yeah. And then the state legislature could overturn it, but they are not, because the Republicans want to keep that in place. And so, again, all elected offices matter. You know, that's how democracy works. But we just don't pay enough attention to the people who have a lot of power. And it doesn't take a lot of votes to beat them.
I agree with everything you just said. I do want to stress that when I talk about media, I'm talking about corporate mainstream media, not journalists.
Corporate.
They're two
that's
separate sources.
Put in front of. Yes, that is exactly right.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of journalists, and I understand the compromises many journalists have to make to pay a mortgage when they work for corporate media. We've all been there, some of us. Also, I agree, state and local elections matter so much more in our everyday lives than what happens with the presidency. And I think that's why it's so amazing that Vote Save America has been honing in, not just on talking about the down ballot races, but also something the media is not doing, reminding people of what's at stake in this election. We get a lot of personality talk. We don't talk about what the actual positions are. And not every state is going to be as lucky as Arizona, having a Supreme Court and a legislature determined to turn out the progressive vote. I mean, hello, yeah. Senator Gallego. Nice to see you. In the other swing states, that's where you guys are focusing your attention. And I got to say, I really admire what Vote Save America is doing and reiterating to people, because the mainstream media is not doing it, what the stakes are in 2024.
Yeah, there's so much. You know, I just talked through abortion, but we've also seen over the past few years book bans. And, you know, that's bad. We shouldn't be, you know, banning books. But I think it also just speaks to, and maybe this might sound a little conspiracy theorist, but it feels like conservatives are actually trying to dumb down our country. And if you have, you know, a populace that's not as smart, then when, you know, people come in and try to just take over, people are less likely to say anything. They're less likely to challenge things. So one, we have these book bans that are banning books that literally teach the history of this country, that, you know, the history of this country is not perfect. And so when people hear that, they might be inclined to feel frustrated and want to fight for better things. And so they're taking that away. And I was just talking to someone about this the other day. When you remove that context, then how can people relate across difference? How will you understand the perspectives and experiences that other people are coming from when you engage with them? You know, how will you understand that you may see someone treat someone, you know, in a racist manner because of the color of their skin? And if you don't have the context to understand what that is and why it's bad, you might just assume it's okay to treat someone who's, you know, Black a certain way. But also thinking about how hard they're making it for people to want to go into the teaching profession. Like, and then everything that's happening at the universities now, and that's a mixed bag with a lot of the response to, you know, Gaza protests and anti-Semitism. But in general, they are trying to kind of dismantle and deteriorate the value of higher education.
Yeah.
And so if more of us are not getting, one, our primary and secondary education, but then more formal advanced training and education, you just have a group of people who are more inclined to go with what the powers that be say. And I do think that is what they're moving toward.
Well, I mean, demonizing education is authoritarianism 101, right? The Third Reich did it. Khmer Rouge did it. Dan Quayle did it. I mean, that's nothing new. But it's why when you get past the designations and actually talk to people about the issues and what's at stake, that's usually, I find, the best chance to pull some of our right-wing brothers and sisters into the light. And I think that's directly what you guys are doing, especially in the swing states.
Yeah. You know, and we've even gone as far. I mean, this is just kind of how we approach things. We talk to people on the ground to understand, like, what is happening in each of the states? What's going to really resonate with people? And so, you know, you look at a place like North Carolina or Virginia might even be a better example. Actually, both are. But we'll go with Virginia. In 2017, Democrats didn't flip the legislature there. But they got really close, so close that it scared the Republicans into passing Medicaid expansion.
That's right.
And people were able to clearly articulate, we'll do this, they won't. Now, they did do it, but it still wasn't enough because, you know, you get to 2019. And I think probably also because Trump was looming, they were able to flip the legislature. But then you look at 2023, Virginia had state legislature elections again, and Glenn Youngkin, who's a Republican, is governor, and for some reason thought a 15-week abortion ban was something that would excite people because it wasn't like a 5 or 6 week abortion ban. But the voters heard that, and they could see very clearly if they put Republicans in charge of the legislature, he'd have all that he needed to pass that 15-week abortion ban. So really, that is what we try to focus on. Like, how is this going to impact people's day to day and making them see that? Because that's what politics means to most people. Well, actually, I think to most people now, it means like arguing back and forth. But what it should be and mean is, you know, a means to a better life. And you should be able to see very clearly who is doing what for you.
Yeah. I mean, I understand that persecuting transgender teenage athletes is important, but maybe it's not the most important issue to your family's day-to-day economic well-being.
Exactly. Exactly. Unless you are related to one of those students and now you hate the people who are doing it to them.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just, it kind of feels like a lose-lose. I don't know why they keep doing that, but.
They keep doing it because they're guided to do it. I mean, we just follow the right-wing media. Every generation has to have a marginalized minority that has no power in society, that the fascist says this is the existential threat to you, whether it's Muslims, whether it's Jews, whether it's organized labor, feminists, gay people who want to get married, undocumented immigrants. This year it's trans kids. You know, every year they've got to find one powerless group that they can terrify the majority with and say, only I can keep you safe from these migrants who want to mow your lawn or these children who want to use a bathroom they're comfortable in. And that's the formula.
Who have never harmed you in any way. I've now pointed out this threat that's always been here. And now that I've pointed it out, you need protection, and I'm here to do it.
So now we're up to another most important election of our lives. It's nice to share this one with you. And I got to say, Vote Safe America, you've got so much going on right now. I know you're always fundraising directly for candidates and causes, and I'm fascinated in how you choose the candidates to help. You're recruiting volunteers for partner organizations. You're deploying the voter registration tools. Let me ask about a few programs like the Anxiety Relief Program. I thought this was a really smart thing to help a democracy that needs it.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. I get really excited talking about this because it is just going so well. Hopefully I'm not supposed to not say anything, but we, so it goes out. It's not a secret. Sometimes we like to like announce these things, but right now, so it's a monthly recurring program. And right now, so I should tell you the way it works before I share the exciting part.
Please.
Basically, we ask people to sign up for whatever amount feels right for them to make a monthly contribution to the Anxiety Relief Program. And right now we have donations ranging from $1 all the way up to $1,000 a month that people are contributing to this fund. And what we do with the money is we look at the needs and requests of our partner organizations or grassroots organizations across the country to see what they're working on and kind of look at the time sensitivity and strategic impact of the work they're doing. And then we basically grant all that money out to organizations every month. And so if you donate $10 every month, that $10 is going back out the door to our grassroots partners. And, you know, when we started this, I thought if we could get up to $50,000 a month, I would be really happy. And that would be amazing. And we are up to the last time I got an update. So it may have gone up by now, but we're up to $230,000 a month that we're able to give out. And so we're able to make like really big, really nice contributions to these organizations. And the reason that's so important right now, I know that there's been a lot of coverage about Joe Biden and how much money he's raised. He's like far outraged Donald Trump, and he just has a lot more money and has, you know, has set some records with his fundraising, which is great. But progressive fundraising for organizations is pretty, it's down. And so something I don't know if people pay attention to it, from 2018 or even 2017, I'd say, through 2022, progressive grassroots organizations played a huge role in the victories that Democrats saw. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to need that infrastructure to continue to exist if we want to continue to see those wins. And so it's not just enough for Joe Biden to have a lot of money. These groups are working right now. They are knocking on doors. Something, you know, especially voters of color hate to see happen. Politicians come in September and start saying, I need your vote. What a lot of these groups are doing now are doing deep canvassing. They're knocking on doors, having really long conversations with voters to understand what's important to you. What do you care about? So that information is being collected so it can be, you know, kind of put out into the world. But also so these voters have a touch point that does not come a few weeks before the election and actually feel like someone is listening to them and taking their considerations into or taking their concerns into consideration. But the other thing that this money is doing, aside from allowing these organizations to do the work they do, is to stay open. Again, progressive fundraising is down. So there are some organizations, most people give closer to elections, but to build a budget and a program and a strategy and get started on it, you can't wait until September to get that money.
That's
and
right.
So we're able to give money out pretty early to help do really early work, but also make sure these organizations are able to sustain themselves until, you know, everyone starts paying attention.
Well, you also do so much to let Americans who care about democracy get engaged. I mean, you've built quite a community of Americans who give a damn about this, and you give a lot of folks a lot of ways to channel their energy, regardless of their age and their background. I understand that now Vote Save America has like its own Slack and anybody can join it.
Yes, we have it's our Vote Save America volunteer community, and we surpassed 5,000, I think it's April. Yeah, probably last month we surpassed 5,000 people in there. And that is basically a place if you have, you know, kind of volunteered a little and now you're like, I want to do more, but I also want to build community with people. That is the place you can come. We have a lot of trainings and they do volunteer events together. Most of them are virtual, but we're starting to get out there and do some in-person stuff. But on their own, the volunteers in this community, if they live near each other, if there's a Pod Save America show or Love It or Leave It show in town, they'll get together before the show and then go to the show together. Yeah. We also have a virtual book club series where they all read a book. When we can, we try to get the author to come in and chat with them about it. But we're really creating space for people to connect with that they might not have otherwise known and just build relationship. And I mean, that's important in life in general, but especially some of our listeners and our audience and volunteers who live in really red states and feel like they're the only one there. We've been able to connect them with people who are nearby. And so it makes this work a lot more fun, especially when, you know, it can get depressing.
Yeah, that's the best part for me of the Sexy Liberal Tour, when we go to red states and we're in communities where, you know, for years, Americans were scared to have an Obama bumper sticker on their car when they went to their job or their church, and to be able to look around and see, oh, my God, I'm in a room with like-minded, sane, progressive people while we're still in the red state, all fighting for the same things. Honestly, those are my favorite kind of audiences, beyond military audiences, the most enthusiastic progressives in red states who are out there fighting, and they know how it's going to go in their state, but they're not giving up because they're here to make the world better.
Exactly. You know, and something we'll get here as soon as we got to grow a little bit and get past this election. But one of my long-term goals for Vote Save America is for us to exist in every state. And every state will require us to do different kinds of work, but especially in those red states, find that little blue dot and just bring people together and keep doing the work to just grow it as big as we can. Because I just don't believe that most, like so many of our red states are not actually red. There's a lot of gerrymandering. Right. There's a lot of voter suppression.
Thank
if we
you.
Could just concentrate the energy to change that, you know, will we turn Idaho blue? Probably not, unless a bunch of progressives go move into the state. But I still do. Well, actually, I heard a lot of people from Washington State are moving into Idaho. So maybe it could happen one day. And even in
look
North
at all
Carolina,
the progress in Alabama. Undoing gerrymandering in Alabama is going to lead to a new blue congressman.
Exactly. And the other thing that does, it tells people, especially you think about a place like Alabama, oh, my vote actually does matter. So now I'm going to vote. Now I'm going to tell other people to vote, because that's the thing. There's lots of forms of voter suppression, but the one that you can't really criminalize or make illegal is just deterring people or convincing people that their vote doesn't matter. And that is something that if people believe that, they will not turn out. You know, when voter ID is put in place and all this other stuff, people will figure it out. But you can't figure out how to, you know, make your vote matter if you don't think it does.
How does Vote Save America determine where to best direct the supporters' money to the most impactful places? I know, like, famously, you guys didn't support Mark Kelly for Senate in 2020 because he already had a lot of money. So how do you ascertain which individuals, and even more importantly, groups, because groups really need the donations more than individual candidates sometime. I mean, how do you ascertain who needs the funds the most in which district?
Yeah. And I will say we did send Mark Kelly volunteers, but we did not send him money because we he did have a lot of money. So we spend like all year. We are talking to our grassroots partners, and a lot of them we've been working with since 2019. And there's, you know, specifically someone on my team who has regular conversations with partners in these different states. I won't say what state, and I'll try to be as vague as possible, but sometimes you have like a lot of groups in one state and they may have different opinions and thoughts on how things should go. So we try to like speak to everyone. And then we look at our own strategy and see whose work actually aligns with it. So, you know, a lot of organizations, national organizations, are going to have a lot of the same targets as far as states and federal races. For instance, when we think about our state Supreme Court races, the states that we've chosen to focus on either can, one, have an up ballot effect where there's exciting candidates. We can either increase, a Dem majority, close a Republican, or make smaller a Republican majority, or flip the court. But these courts also align with some other strategic priorities where we hope that, for instance, if people are not excited about Biden in that state, but we can get them excited about a state Supreme Court race candidate,
exactly. Then
we'll have that up ballot impact. And so that's something I didn't mention before. I don't want this to sound like I'm diminishing the importance of these down ballot races, but they also, in a moment where people are not excited about the top of the ticket, provide an opportunity for us to highlight and showcase really exciting new leaders who will also turn people out for the people at the top of the ticket.
That is why you are my favorite member of the entire Crooked Media family, because you are actually getting people to turn out and vote. And we can't have abortion and weed on the ballot in every state. Shaniqua McClendon is the VP of politics for Crooked Media. What is the best way for our listeners to learn more and to help learn about volunteering for Vote Save America?
Yeah, if you go to votesaveamerica.com, you should sign up. Right now, we do have volunteer opportunities up there right now, which you can find through our Action Finder. But if you go to votesaveamerica.com, put your email address in and sign up, we will be launching our new volunteer program on May 6th. And so if you're signed up already, you'll be one of the first people to get a note about that. But yeah, we are officially shifting gears and really just picking up the pace now.
Shaniqua, thank you so much for joining us again. I hope it's a smooth election year for you. I'm going to try to get you here as often as possible. I hope you take time to breathe, because I know how much work you're doing. Thank you and all the volunteers at Vote Save America for all the work.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.